Hey, welcome to the Mindspace podcast. I'm Joe Flanders. Thanks for tuning in. When I thought about starting a podcast, it was really the opportunity to do interviews like the one I did today that got me the most motivated. So I'm just incredibly excited to bring to you today the conversation I had with Willoughby Britton and Jared Lindahl. Let me provide a little context. This podcast is partly brought to you by Mindfulness Montreal. Mindfulness Montreal is a not-for-profit community initiative I co-founded in 2015. And our mission is to bring mindfulness practitioners, teachers, and healthcare professionals in Montreal together. And we have a really cool event coming up in April featuring Willoughby and Jared and David Trelevin, who I will speak about in a moment. It's April 19th to 21st, and it's called Mindfulness Growing Pains. And we're going to be talking about the risks and challenges associated with practicing and teaching meditation. So the event's going to include a public lecture on the 19th and a two-day training for mindfulness or meditation teachers on the 20th and 21st. And so we're going to be speaking about this event a little bit in my interview with Willoughby and Jared. All the information about the event, by the way, is available at mindfulnessmtl.com, and on Facebook, it's mindfulnessmtl. So David Trelevin is an expert in trauma-sensitive mindfulness, and he just published a book on that, and I hope to be speaking to him in a few weeks. But today I had about an hour with Willoughby and Jared, and as I said, it was super interesting. A brief intro on them. Willoughby is an assistant professor of psychiatry and public health at Brown. She's also a clinical psychologist and a clinical and affective neuroscientist. Dr. Jared Lindahl is a visiting assistant professor of religious studies. He's the director of the humanities research track in the clinical and affective neuroscience lab, where Willoughby works as well. Our conversation covered a couple of, or several, really interesting topics, including Willoughby's widely appreciated 2011 TED Talk, where she was very enthusiastic and optimistic about the emergence of contemplative neuroscience, and then her transition to a more critical stance on mindfulness research and the whole mindfulness movement. We got Jared's take on the explosion of interest in mindfulness in the West and the importance of sensitivity to individual differences and cultural diversity in this space. We talked a little bit about the state of the science of meditation, particularly our understanding of adverse experiences in meditation. And of course, they touched on the training they developed to help mindfulness and meditation teachers deal with adverse experiences that their students have. So you could learn more about Willoughby and Jared's work on their lab website. And so that's brown.edu/research/labs/Britton, B-R-I-T-T-O-N. And of course, you can learn everything you need to know about Mindfulness Montreal, again, at mindfulnessmtl.com. And anything you need to know about Mindspace, you can find it at mindspacewellbeing.com. Or you can reach me at Dr. Joe Flanders on Facebook or Twitter. So Willoughby and Jared, welcome to the podcast. Thanks so much for being here.
Thanks for having us.
Maybe you guys can just tell us what you do on a day-to-day basis in these roles.
Well, I think, you know, we generally conduct research into the effects of contemplative practices on the brain and body. So that would sort of be a general overview. And I think our lab in particular maybe specializes in practice-specific effects. So looking at how different practices affect the brain and body and moderators of treatment outcomes. So looking at what types of factors influence who maximally benefits from different kinds of contemplative practices. So those are kind of some of the key questions that I'm interested in.
Yeah, and in addition to teaching students at Brown and working with students in our lab here, I think the other thing that we've been working on quite a bit is trying to get some of our research published and available for people to read, as both of the projects we've been working on for close to the last decade have gone through long periods of data collection and data analysis. And now we're really trying to work on dissemination of that information.
Okay.
And one thing I would add to that is having been a researcher, I've been at Brown now almost 12 years, and I've learned that it takes between 12 and 17 years for a scientific discovery to actually make it to its end user, which could be, you know, a doctor, a clinician, educator, or even a meditator. And that's just way too long. So this is called the science to service gap. So we've also been very interested in how to make sure that the science we're doing actually gets to the end users, like people who want to start meditating, people who are learning to teach meditation. How do they interface with the science, and how do we get that to them in a faster way? So that's more along the lines of what we call dissemination research.
Well, to the extent that this podcast can help with that aspect of your work, I'm very happy to be a part of it. If it's okay, I'd like to start with you, Willoughby. I first came across your work in your 2011 TEDx talk, and I had just started kind of building a community of mindfulness practitioners and you know, health professionals at Mindspace, and it was so inspiring. It was so exciting, your hope and enthusiasm for the emergence of contemplative neuroscience. I mean, all the promise that that field meant for promoting well-being in the world. And then more recently, you've become a little bit more critical of the mindfulness movement, so to speak. So I'm just curious what happened, you know, personally and professionally in that period. You know, what changed or what moved for you?
Yeah, I think that you're really pointing to the remarkable rapidity of the field, like how fast it's growing and how fast it's maturing. So I think, you know, back in 2011, my TED talk was one of the first TED talks on mindfulness or meditation that existed. And I don't know how many there are now, but there are a lot. And so that was, you know, that was kind of mindfulness 1.0. It was really the first phase of mindfulness was just getting it out there, like making sure that it was sort of a household word and it was sort of common sense for anybody to try it out. And I think that that 1.0 is extremely successful, and you know, the level of enthusiasm is, we don't need more enthusiasm. The field has plenty of enthusiasm. So we're at mindfulness 2.0 now, which is a different phase, and we need, on top of the enthusiasm that already exists and the rapid proliferation of mindfulness programs and apps and products, you know, we need some clarity, we need some precision, and really some rigor in the field to make sure that again, the science is keeping, or I should say the end users are keeping up with the science and what we know. So I think that's kind of what's changed, is that what the field needs now is a lot. It needs a critical, you know, look into what the boundary conditions of mindfulness are, what it can and can't do. Like I was saying before, practice specific effects, moderators of treatment outcome, who benefits, who doesn't. We just have a lot of questions to answer. It's, you know, the research is not over. So that's kind of where we're at now.
So I'm curious, on a personal level, what was it like for you to move from mindfulness 1.0 to 2.0, just in the sense that maybe it's a more pleasant or more exciting state of mind to be in that hopeful and kind of exploratory phase?
I mean, yeah, it's also more hopeful and exciting when you start to fall in love, and then you realize that relationships are different than that first infatuation phase, and they're deeper, but they're also more complicated and difficult. So I think it's pretty similar to any kind of relationship where there's a honeymoon period. So, you know, yeah, it was fun to be part of that initial crowd, and I've been in the field almost 20 years, and there was a tremendous amount of enthusiasm, but that's, you know, that's not really that accurate. So if you're pursuing sort of truth, I'm interested in staying with with what's true and accurate and not what just sounds good and what's a good soundbite. So
Jared, if I can turn it over to you, it never ceases to amaze me how quickly mindfulness grew in the West in the last 10 years or so. I wonder what your take is on why that might have happened and what challenges this is creating for just this interesting sort of clash of different cultures, religious communities, secular versus spiritual takes. What's your assessment of this really insane cultural phenomenon?
Yeah, I think that the story starts quite a bit longer than 10 years ago, though obviously the rapid changes maybe have really picked up in that time period. But really back in the latter half of the 19th century, there were some interesting things happening in Asia even that influenced how Buddhism came to the West. And one of those was a sort of newer emphasis on lay meditation practice and kind of larger scale meditation retreats, especially in Southeast Asia, the Vipassana tradition, that weren't really, you know, comparable to maybe some prior phenomena where meditation might have been more exclusively practiced by monastics and even select monastics at that. And I think in terms of what happened when Buddhism was transmitted to the West, there were also some, deliberate and intentional maneuvers that presented it as either a science unto itself or at the very least compatible with science. You see some of this language even at places like the World Parliament of Religions in the late 19th century. And I think that really spoke to some of the trends of the 20th century, and I think also our often very Protestant notions of religion as being about belief, and specifically a belief in God or a God, has allowed Buddhism to sometimes get treated as more of a philosophy or a lifestyle in the West. And, you know, of course, there under other conceptions or definitions of religion, Buddhism is quite clearly that. There's rituals and sets of standard dogmas and hierarchical institutions and notions of salvation and so on. But the modern sort of individualist and secular, and either psychological or philosophical approaches to Buddhism have resulted in this sort of kind of selective reading of the tradition. And certainly it has a rich philosophical tradition, and it has these rich collection of contemplative practices. But to see it as exclusively that, I think, is somewhat myopic and overlooks some of the ways in which it's clearly also a major world religion and has been for many, many hundreds of years. The science of meditation and its psychological applications, I think, and this is where it gets a little bit more recent, have certainly contributed to ways in which of supporting the Buddhism as a science or Buddhism as empirical narrative. And again, while there are certainly some ways in which that makes good sense, and there's been some nice and valid attempts to really demonstrate some of the psychological merits or empirical validity of certain Buddhist ideas or practices, I think there's also a kind of risky tendency to also assume that because one part of the tradition can be framed as compatible with science or even empirical, but all the rest of it surely must be based in this too. And this has led, I think, to some untested hypotheses being treated as fact and a real kind of confusion really over where the line between the science of meditation and Buddhism as a religion can be clearly drawn. Mm. And mindfulness as a movement, I think, is curiously in that in-between space as this very contested category, in the sense that it can mean a lot of different things to a lot of different people in a lot of different contexts.
I wonder if you would agree that there's something particularly stressful, or that there's a particularly high level of suffering in contemporary Western life that makes people hungry for meditation practice, and that might contribute to how quickly it's grown?
My take on this, and I think Willoughby will maybe have her own, is I don't know that it's necessarily stress, or maybe it depends on how we think about that, or suffering. Maybe more what I'm interested in, or at least I'm picking up on, is maybe how it's also potentially filling a vacuum around meaning, and that it's providing some sort of narrative of meaning and purpose in life, and a sort of vector for self-transformation, some sort of conceptions of well-beings and norms around behaviors that maybe have been absent, especially maybe in this shift from being having a very religious identity to a lot of people in our culture also now sort of having a loss of the meaning that religions once provided, as science and secularism become more dominant cultural trends. So maybe that's part of it, and that's also another factor at play.
So I'm glad you mentioned the controversy around the science, because it's obviously an important issue and something you guys have a lot to say about. I want to talk about the sort of the pushback in recent years from the scientific community and this effort to really rein in the hype. And I use the word hype deliberately because I know, Willoughby, you're an author on a recent paper called Mind the Hype that came out in Psychological Science. Maybe you could talk about that, including what do we actually know? What can we say with integrity about the benefits of meditation? And then, what is a bit overhyped and what work needs to be done?
Yeah, so the Mind the Hype paper was actually, I think, the first consensus statement by 15 different mindfulness researchers from all around the world. And it was in response to this rapid proliferation of mindfulness products, apps, programs, in a way that's really outpacing what we know scientifically. And it was, we're concerned that there's a lot of untested programs and claims being proliferated out there to people who they just don't have the information to be able to sort of protect themselves. So we wanted to put that out there as a way to help consumers be more informed. So, I mean, I think, most people, and including myself at various stages, are very surprised to learn that the science of mindfulness is actually not as far along as we think, and that the support for the practices and what they can and can't do is also not as strong as we think. And I think one of the problems that we talk about, one of the core problems that we describe in this paper, is that, there's still not a consensus definition of what mindfulness is. And so there's lots of different stakeholders and different people who have different definitions. And sometimes those definitions not only disagree with each other, but like completely contradict. So for example, mindfulness can be, a complete closeness and intimacy with yourself. And it can also be an increased distance from yourself and your experience. So the issue of flow versus metacognition, those two things are often equated with what mindfulness is. So I think that we're not going to come to a consensus definition of mindfulness. Different Buddhist groups are still fighting about different things in Buddhism too. So that it's, this is a long-standing problem that is not going to be solved by coming to a common definition. But what I do think we're going to have is we're going to have many different kinds of mindfulness, and we'll probably have to rename them into, different kinds of approaches and practices that have different aims and different goals and are just different from each other. And then we can do science on, which types of mindfulness are good for what and good for who. And so I think we just need a lot more precision just around the basic definition of what mindfulness is. So I can't even say what is mindfulness good for? Because I don't even know what you mean by the term.
Okay. So if, you know, speaking of informed consumers, if I wanted to speak totally honestly to someone approaching me with some interest in learning to meditate for their well-being, would I say, well, the science basically says that it would be just as useful for you to go buy some essential oils and some crystals and go for a walk. Can we make any distinctions there?
Well, I think it depends on what they're hoping to use the practice for. And also what practice they intend to use. So if they're saying, I'm thinking about taking an MBSR course for stress or depression or MBCT, you know, then you can start to look at the data for that. And then they have a specific answer. Mm-hmm. But I think you need to know exactly what program they're aiming to do and what they're aiming to do it for. And then I think you can start to answer that question. You know, there are studies that have found that, you know, watching nature films is just as good as seeing mindfulness, depending on what you want to do it for. So I think it really depends on your purpose.
All right. So let's talk about the Varieties of Contemplative Experience project. I know a paper came out last year, and you guys are in the middle of doing a lot more work. Maybe just tell us about this project and what we can now say about the darker side of meditation.
Yeah, so the Varieties of Contemplative Experience project, you know, had a couple different precursors. One, Jared and I have both been practicing for more than 20 years, so we have a lot of experience with different types of practice in our own lives. And when I was doing my psychiatric residency, there were two people that came off a meditation retreat, and they were having, you know, psychotic episodes. So that was a very extreme example of, you know, more challenging kinds of experiences. And, you know, on top of my own experiences and, you know, different kinds of experiences that friends and teachers I'd had, it sort of just reminded me that this, you know, the benefits of meditation and all the research that we've been doing was not really the whole story. And so we started this study, which was really, if you want to know, you know, what kinds of challenges or difficulties or adverse effects are occurring with meditation, who better to ask but meditation teachers that run meditation centers. So that's where we started this qualitative interview-based study. We went to different meditation centers and we went to the directors and we asked them, you know, what types of practices have you observed in your students? And what type of experience have you had in your own practice? And many of the teachers described, you know, their own challenges and they gave subject interviews and then they also gave teacher interviews. So that's kind of, you know, the very simple kind of background that study started was just asking meditation teachers what they'd seen.
Okay. Oh, what could we say about, and putting this question out to both of you, what can we now say about who is more at risk for adverse experiences in meditation?
So I think there is a strong tendency to look for the cause of meditation related challenges in the meditator. And this is actually known as the fundamental attribution error. So I think that is maybe not the question to ask is who is at risk, but rather the question are what types of factors may increase or decrease the tendency for difficulties to happen and for those difficulties to be associated with impairment and distress. And, you know, we had 59 categories of experiences that across seven domains that appeared in the Varieties project. And then in addition to that, there were 26 categories of influencing factors that can, again, increase or decrease the likelihood that these experiences occur, how long they last, and whether they're associated with distress and impairment. So, Yeah, I think that saying who's at risk, I think it's, you know, again, it's a really common question. And I think it's based in this idea of this tendency to find causal attribution to a person. But we haven't actually found, you know, really any support for dispositional causes, meaning causes that exist within the practitioner.
I will also add that our qualitative study just really fundamentally isn't designed to answer that question. What we were trying to do with the qualitative research is, as Willoughby explained, by starting with interviewing teachers about experiences they had seen and managed in practitioners that they've worked with, as well as then interviewing practitioners for, you know, kind of richer layer of detail, an explanation of what it was like to undergo challenging experiences and how they interpreted them, that really gives us a sense of the scope of the issue. It gives us a sense of what should be looked for in further research on this topic. But in order to really assess something like risk in any sort of definitive way, you need a different research methodology than a qualitative one. This was a very exploratory project, and hopefully it'll be groundwork for future researchers to try to do more to assess risk. But I think they're going to have to keep in mind that how that plays out is also going to be relative to the particular context or community that's being studied, the types of practices that they're undertaking, the reasons why they're undertaking them. There's a whole lot of other variables, as Willoughby mentioned, beyond the practitioner level variables that further complicate the ability to really identify, you know, individual differences, for instance, as a main variable or factor.
I mean, I would go on to say that, you know, while it's true that the Varieties Project was not designed to, it was a qualitative study, so it really wasn't designed to look at causal relationships between variables, I think we did find, you know, some data that challenge some of the common notions around risk. So if you look on the internet, you'll find lots of statements about, you know, difficult experiences, you know, only happen to people with a psychiatric or trauma history. It only happens to people who practice, you know, 5 hours a day or just a lot. It only happens to people who practice incorrectly or have improper supervision. And, you know, we found exceptions to all of those statements. So these were many of the people in our study, more than 60%, were meditation teachers themselves, often like the, you know, the directors of centers, had many, many years of experience, had no psychiatric or trauma history, and were trained by the, you know, the best teachers we have in that are living today. So it's not that those factors don't play a role. Of course they play a role, but they're not the, you know, they're not the only thing that's happening.
I would say that a lot of people listening to this and people I spoke to about interviewing you guys are clinicians. And so there's a lot of interest in best practices and screening, which I know you guys will be addressing in the workshop. But what I'm hearing is that we're not really at the point where we're developing best practices, but we even have to change the way we're asking the questions because of some of what you're finding. So it's really interesting, and I thank you for the clarity on that. I wanted to run a quick example by you to get your sense of how you would address it. I recently co-founded a meditation studio in Montreal, and it's been open for a few months, called Presence. And in, I think, about a month or two in, someone was meditating in a class, and there was some kind of discussion after the practice, and the discussion even got a little bit heated with the teacher, challenging certain assumptions that the student had about meditation or Buddhism or what have you. And the student had some kind of difficulty, some kind of breakdown, sort of the way they were speaking lost its coherence, and there was clearly some difficulty in staying connected to the interpersonal interaction and the sort of reality in the room at that moment. And this really highlighted for us that these things happen and that nobody really was equipped to handle it well. So it's one of the reasons we got motivated to reach out to you. Obviously, you wouldn't have a protocol based on your research, but what sorts of things come to mind for you when you hear about this thing? The student in the end was fine. There was just a sort of a momentary sort of disconnection and came back a few minutes later with some support of the teacher. But what sorts of things do you think the teacher should be paying attention to in those moments?
So the training that we're going to be offering is really coming out of a trauma-sensitive approach. And there is actually a foundational text that goes with it. It's called Trauma-Sensitive Mindfulness that was written by David Treleaven. But it's drawing from a large body of trauma-informed approaches. And so I think that, you know, for that particular situation, which of course I wasn't there and I don't know exactly what happened, so it's hard to say, but there would be a lot of work that could be done long before that happened. So that both the teacher and the meditator would have a lot more resources and sort of guidelines to go with before you're just suddenly confronted with a difficulty. So for example, in a sort of trauma-informed approach, you would start off all of your classes by, you know, training people to locate and identify their own resources, places in their body that are safe, you know, objects in the room, colors, anything that they can connect with that's safe and has a feeling of strength and groundedness, so that you already have that to refer to when you start to become destabilized. So that's the first thing, would just be having access to resources and before you start anything. And then the second thing to know would be able to identify, for each person to be able to identify, what are signs that you're kind of going outside of your own window of tolerance, you know, that you're starting to like dissociate. What is your sign of that for you? So each person has a strong repertoire of knowing what it's like to become, you know, so highly aroused that they're not able to stay present anymore. Like, what does that feel like? And be able to have, so that the teacher also knows about what this person's tendencies are. So they're in some ways pre-tracking them, and the person already knows what their tendencies are and like has a sense. So in that moment, which it sounds like everyone was caught off guard and nobody had the vocabulary to talk about it, which I think is a common thing. In that moment, if you had done all that pre-preparation work, then you would be able to ask what was happening and have like, oh, I'm dissociating, or I'm outside my window of tolerance. Or maybe they would even have been taught that when you are approaching your body's capacity to be present, that you move your attention away from the arousal. And so maybe that wouldn't have happened in the first place, because the person would have been taught to basically keep themselves within the window of tolerance. But maybe not. Maybe it would have happened anyway. And then you can, you know, there are a number of different kinds of techniques that you can use to bring someone back into connection. So I don't know if that answers your question.
Yeah, that's really super interesting. And it does speak to the challenge of being sensitive to individual differences. And I've heard you speak on that in other contexts. And I wonder if we can bring in Jared to talk about, you know, the importance of cultural diversity as well. Maybe it's not obvious to people why cultural diversity is another super important consideration in a context like the one we're talking about.
Sure. So I think, you know, Willoughby covered quite a bit earlier some of the ways in which individual differences may or may not be playing a role, or maybe they're playing a partial role. And certainly among the various influencing factors that we presented in our main paper for the varieties of contemplative experience, we had, in addition to those practitioner level factors, various variables taking place at the level of the practice and the way the practice is approached, and also the social context or the relationships. And that can be relationships within the community. It can be relationships with the teacher of that community, relationships beyond the community, the general friends and family network of the practitioner, and then also their broader identity and sociocultural context. So certainly, I think a lot of these variables at the social and relational level do highlight that not everybody is coming to a meditation community or a meditation context from the same place. They have their own not only life narratives, but maybe also conceptions of what well-being is, conceptions of what emotions they want to have or want to work with or what are worth having, their goals for meditating. And this can obviously, as we talked earlier, range from very secular and psychological in nature to very traditional and embedded in a religious system and a religious cosmology and those conceptions of what salvation means. So each community, and I think this is particularly true in the West, where there's such a wide range of discourses around meditation, and meditation has cut across both the secular and religious groups, that it's not often probably the case that we can sort of take for granted a certain set of assumptions and expectations and intentions for any given meditator in a community. And I think that the particular ways in which they've encountered meditation in the past and why they are drawn to it in the present could really fit or not fit with the particular community in which they find themselves. And that was certainly a main theme in the qualitative study, that supportive teachers and supportive communities that really understood the person and their challenges were often very, very helpful. But by contrast, teachers that didn't really understand them, or for whom they felt like there was a big cultural gap or rift, or communities that shunned them or didn't really know what to do with them when they were encountering difficulties, that was only compounding things and making that initial challenge and difficulty even more challenging and harmful for them.
I know of some recent data that is shows some similar findings on the impact of cultural diversity in a psychotherapy context. So sure. That's very cool to hear those correspond like that. So you guys have developed this training, again, on this sort of dissemination angle. And I guess I'd like to start with the motivation, the origins of this training. I know, Willoughby, when you started getting involved in this research, you were quite active in your community on campus and supporting people going through these difficulties. And I'm guessing your motivation to create some formal training came from your early experiences doing that. Is that correct?
I think it was a confluence of many factors. I mean, I'm also very involved with, creating best practices with the various centers for mindfulness, the UMass, Bangor, Oxford, all that have MBI training programs. So I think there was a lot of discussion about, whether MBI instructors should have clinical training, and when they decided that MBCT decided that they didn't need clinical training, there was kind of a gap in what the competencies were. So a number of MBI teachers we discovered didn't know how to do a screening. They didn't know what questions to ask. They didn't know how to identify mental health issues. So I actually voted against that decision. And so when the vote went the other direction, I was like, I will personally, help train people to get up to speed at what they need to know. So that was another part of the issue, was I think I was very much motivated by the number of people that I see personally, like, you know, who I work with, who come to me, who have had difficulties, and a strong desire not to create more of those people, to make sure that people who are learning to teach MBIs have the knowledge and training that they need, basic clinical knowledge, but also because we have this data now, like really the most comprehensive data really ever on, you know, various types of challenges that come up in meditation. It was a really good time to put this stuff together. So in terms of what we're offering, in the training, it's six modules. The first module is the overview of research on, you know, what types of challenges come up in meditation, both in the context of, Buddhist meditation centers, but also a replication study within mindfulness-based interventions. So that's the first module. The second module is informed consent, how to convey realistic expectations about the potential benefits and risks. It's really about, you know, sort of truth in advertising and making sure that the program that you're offering and the training you have is the best fit for what the person's coming for. The third module is screening. Again, like, what exactly do you say during a screening? Do you have a screening instrument? Do you know how to interpret it? Really basic things like that. The fourth module is monitoring. How would you know if somebody was having an adverse reaction? I think often we expect that our, you know, participants are going to spontaneously report that they're having an adverse reaction to the teacher in the middle of class. And like, we know that doesn't happen. People are very reluctant to tell us that they're having problems, and we need to do more than that, passive monitoring. We need to ask specific questions. It needs to be anonymous. It can't be done by the teacher because there's too many demand characteristics in that relationship. There's a lot of parameters of how to do monitoring correctly. So we want to make sure we convey those. The fifth one is mechanism. So we do actually know a lot about how different practices affect the brain and body. And since we know about that, then we can really understand why certain types of symptoms might come about. So for example, I think I even talked about this in my TED talk, you know, many types of practices strengthen the prefrontal cortex, and it's about its ability to control the limbic system, which is great. You can have a little bit of decrease in emotional reactivity, but if that, you know, process continues, then you can basically suppress your limbic emotional brain enough so that you become blunted, where you basically don't have any emotions left. So, you know, we can really understand if we can really understand the mechanism, we can understand why these are happening. So that's the fifth one. And then the sixth one is management, which again is really drawing from the trauma-informed approaches that I was describing earlier, you know, resourcing, window of tolerance, titration, things like that.
Okay, very cool. I highly encourage anyone teaching mindfulness and meditation to check this out, because I really do think it's an indispensable aspect of training to teach these practices. So I'm really excited that you guys are doing this and that we're fortunate enough to have it in Montreal. Maybe I can end on with one final question. Given that you guys are really focused on studying and understanding and helping people deal with the darker side of meditation, I'm curious how all this work and all this focus has impacted your own personal practices.
I mean, that's probably a book-length answer, but I can say that I think when I first started, I was this is like 20 years ago, 25 years ago, when I first started, I thought that, you know, mindfulness was one thing and that it could do everything, which I think is a pretty common starting point for a lot of people. And, you know, now I know that there are actually many, many different types of practices that are designed to do different things. And so I think that for me, I had to get really clear on what my goals were and what types of qualities and behaviors I wanted to cultivate, and then decide which practice was the best fit for those goals. So I think that, you know, the whole shebang has been reconfigured for me. And I think that's often very, a very common trajectory for people to realize that they have options.
What about you, Jared?
Yeah, I think mine is a much shorter answer, but along the same lines. I think it has certainly encouraged me to reflect critically on what my particular goals are for how to live and for what qualities I want to cultivate, and also to think how best, both within and beyond meditation, to attain those goals. I think that a lot of people in our research project in, have reported that when they went through this period of difficulty, they realized sort of how much of their own almost individuality or autonomy they had sort of surrendered to this, to a teacher or to a system or to some value or goal, without maybe really considering always how much of them was in that project, and kind of realizing through the maybe some of the struggle and some of the difficulty that they needed to reclaim some of their own authority and autonomy and start, you know, really steering their own ship a bit more than they had in the past.
All right. Thank you so much for talking to me about all this today. And thanks for doing the amazing work that you're doing. And we're looking forward to seeing you in Montreal in a couple of months.
Until then.
All right. Thanks, guys.